Rivers are the lifeblood of the American West. We depend on them to provide water, power, protein, recreation, and so much more. Yet our dependence on rivers has paradoxically changed them in ways that threaten their ability to sustain our own livelihoods. River scientists have worked hard to understand the properties of rivers and have uncovered fascinating details about how these ecosystems work. They have learned that healthy rivers are physically complex, biologically diverse, and thrive best when they are allowed to change naturally over time. Wyatt Cross, professor in the Department of Ecology and director of the Montana Water Center at Montana State University, tells us about this subject in his talk, Rivers of the American West, Embracing Biological Complexity for a Sustainable Future, presented by the Ivan Doig Center for the Study of Lands and Peoples, recorded at the Museum of the Rockies on October 28, 2019.
So I'm Wyatt Cross. I'm in the Department of Ecology here at MSU, and I love rivers. Who loves rivers? And so I want to share with you tonight some ideas, some concepts, some fascinating details about rivers that keep me excited about the things I do, keep me excited about my job. Some of what I'm going to talk about today may be familiar to many of you, but I hope that some of it's not. And I can at least leave you with some new nuggets in terms of gaining a stronger appreciation for how river ecosystems work and why it might be so important that we prioritize their conservation into the future. So, here we go. This is my task tonight, okay, is to convince you all that rivers are beautifully complex ecosystems, okay? Not complex in the sense of complicated, or disorderly, or impossible to understand, but complex in an ordered way. Okay, complex in a way that generates critical variation in the physical environment. That's absolutely central for these ecosystems. Rivers are complex in ways that promote biological diversity and maintain critical species interactions among the members of these communities. And I want to ultimately convince you that rivers are complex in a way that enhances their resilience to global change. Okay, when rivers are allowed to do what they love to do, they are resilient to change. And if we can understand something about this complexity, if we can unravel, sort of peel back the layers of the onion and understand complexity, then we've got a really good chance of conserving our rivers and perhaps even rehabilitating or restoring the ones that need our help. So here's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to talk about why rivers matter. Why should we even care about these things? What's all this hubbub about complexity? What the heck are you talking about? Are we dismantling river complexity? What are the ways that our society is starting to unravel and sort of erode river complexity? And finally, is there hope? Where do we go from here? So these are rivers of the continental U.S., and I want to start with this image because I think it's really important to visualize, at least at a macro scale, just how finely dissected our landscapes are by rivers. Okay, and what's so remarkable to me about this image is that it doesn't even include the tiniest little branches at the tips of these streams. If it did, this would be almost completely blue. Okay. And so this brings up a couple of things for me. The first is that rivers fundamentally are responding to what happens on the landscape. They receive the things that come from the landscape. And so they're particularly vulnerable to our activities. Okay? The other thing that I think about is that, man, we've got to start thinking about these ecosystems as a vast circulatory network of the Earth's system. Okay? And a vast circulatory network that's absolutely vital for the function of the Earth system. And you're probably thinking, whoa, that's sort of a bold statement. And so I want to back that up. Okay, why are rivers so darn important for the Earth? First of all, rivers slowly erode continents. Okay, so they're constantly eroding materials from the continents and delivering stuff to the oceans. Okay, sediment, nutrients, organic matter, and things like that. And under the best case scenarios, under natural scenarios, this is so fundamentally important for building coastal habitat, for building barrier islands, for supporting estuary. And also, of course, the stuff that's being delivered is the fuel for these productive ecosystems in estuary, near shore, and coastal environments. So rivers feed the oceans. That's a critical part of their function. Now, Rivers aren't just passive conduits of stuff, okay? We've learned in the last few decades that they're super important and reactive, and they can do magical things like transform dissolved nitrogen in the river to nitrogen gas in the atmosphere through a process called denitrification. And it's been estimated that about 20% of global denitrification happens in rivers. Okay, so rivers are sort of natural water treatment plants, right? They're doing the work that we don't necessarily have to do if we leave them alone. This is sort of new, so we now know that rivers over the past, well, I guess in the last decade or so, we realized rivers are a critical part of the global carbon cycle. We can't ignore their role in the global carbon cycle. So whatever we do to rivers has impacts on what happens to how carbon cycles on a global scale. That's huge. Now, again, when rivers are allowed to wander and explore their floodplains, they perform natural flood control. So this beautiful image of the Paraná River in Argentina is an example of a river that it really nicely buffers floods when they come along because of this very complex physical channel, okay? And we know all too well what happens when we constrain and try to maintain our rivers in their boundaries. This is a huge flood on the Mississippi River in Missouri. So they provide this natural flood control function. Rivers provide food security. Okay, on the Pacific Northwest coast, up into Canada and Alaska, there are many human communities that depend on productive rivers and productive fisheries, like the salmon fisheries. That's super, super important. And it's even more extreme in other parts of the world. So places like the Mekong River. This is a river that when it floods, that flood supports a massively important fishery that feeds about 60 million people in 6 countries, okay? So we're talking about a massive, massive importance of rivers for providing food for humans. And finally, rivers are absolutely hotspots of biodiversity, okay? Even though they make up just a tiny fraction of the Earth's water, we've described a full 6% of the global biodiversity in freshwaters, okay? That's a lot. And if you look at this on an aerial basis, so the number of species described per million square kilometers, of course, the number of species described in freshwater ecosystems dwarfs that of land or marine. And unfortunately, as you'll see here, this is also true of the number of imperiled species per area in these ecosystems. So these are real hotspots of biodiversity, and that biodiversity is critical. So these last few slides, the things I'm talking about are something that we often call ecosystem goods and services, okay? And you may have heard this term before, but these are things that we receive when ecosystems are functioning naturally, okay? And we receive these things, these benefits, more or less for free, okay? So things like an adequate supply of water, protein, buffering of floods, performing this natural maintenance of water quality, but also things like recreation and tourism. These things are so, so important here in Montana. And just the aesthetics of rivers, right? It just provides a really huge amount of well-being to human society. Some people call these things nature's services. Some people call this the natural capital of our ecosystems. But it's really important. Now, over the past century or so, of course, most of human society has either ignored this or largely undervalued the fact that naturally functioning ecosystems provide these things for us for free, okay? And we've done a pretty good job of slowly eroding the ability of rivers to provide these services. The tragedy is that we don't know why. We don't understand why. We don't understand the mechanisms behind this, okay? And what I'm going to argue tonight is that that's a huge deal because those goods and services, the things that we receive from these ecosystems, fundamentally are maintained by natural complexity, both biological and physical complexity that exists when rivers are allowed to do what they like to do, okay? And so this is a familiar sight, right? We all love to go fishing for huge native cutthroat trout in Montana. Every year we go out and there are these productive fisheries that are stable over time and we can take advantage of this. But it's time that we start remembering that these benefits, this good that we receive from the ecosystem is fundamentally maintained by a hidden network of very intricate interactions among organisms, okay? They're feeding on each other, competing with one another, and so on. And these are the things that provide a productive fishery, that provide a stable fishery over time, okay? And it's high time we start understanding this complexity. Now, complexity. What the heck am I talking about? I want to give you a tour of a little bit of the complexity that we see in river ecosystems. And I don't think, you know, most of us are pretty familiar with the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. We see this stuff. We see forests, grasslands, all of the animals and things living in these things, interacting, and so on. But we're probably a little less familiar with what's going on under the surface of the water, right? And so I want to take you on a brief little tour into a river. Okay, that's not in a river. But this is the big dog, right, in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. We know that this top predator is so important in structuring these ecosystems in terms of competing and preying on things and so on. And we're probably pretty familiar with this, right? That in rivers we think about, okay, who's the top predator in rivers? Maybe at least within the boundary of the river, it's things like Yellowstone cutthroat trout, right? But there's fewer of us are familiar with the amazing, incredible diversity of things that are smaller than that, okay? Like these critters right here. So here's an extremely handsome caddisfly, a Rhyocophilidae caddisfly that's a huge, important predator in streams all around us in Bozeman. Look at this face. Oh my gosh. This is an odonate, a dragonfly larva, and here's a beautiful stonefly. These are invertebrate predators that are equally as important as the fishes in these ecosystems. Here's a little video of one, okay, kind of wandering around on the benthic environment in the stream, looking for prey, and they're pretty ferocious and sort of weird. So one thing here, so we got a piece of prey here, hanging on to a midge larva, and these guys are pretty crazy because they're piercing, sucking predators. And this is, you can avert your eyes if this gets to be too much, but they kill their prey with mandibles, so they start chewing on their prey like you can see here. And then they'd suck the juices out of their prey. Okay, so they don't eat big chunks of these things. They start sucking on them. So here's another one that has a piece of prey that's slowly sucking the juices out. This is the stuff that we don't see and is so incredible. And a lot of the imagery, I should say, are Joe Gersh, who works for the USGS, just amazing videos, and Mike McDonald, who's here. There's going to be some photos of his. Okay, so Yellowstone, we're back. We understand this. We think about the grasslands. We look out there and we say, oh, bison, we're familiar with bison. We know bison have really important influences on the communities, the plant communities, and so on. But we probably spend less time thinking about this, the herbivores that live in fresh water. So here we are zoomed in onto a rock, looking at a betadae, a mayfly larva that is very happily feeding. Here's some big pieces of macroalgae. But what it's doing is it's focused on a tiny microbial biofilm that you can't even see. Okay, it's invisible to the naked eye. And it can do that because of these amazing mouthpart morphologies, little brushes and scrapers that allow it to very carefully remove pieces of this microbial biofilm that it's going for. Okay, so very happily chomping away. Let's zoom into that biofilm. So here we are. These are scanning electron micrographs. So we're less than millimeter size here. And you can see these beautiful diatom cells. These are the important photosynthesizers in these ecosystems, covered in fungal mycelia, another diatom species here, lots of bacteria and so forth. Just an incredible diversity of organisms that exists that we can't even see. This is one of my favorite images. This is a freeze fracture scanning electron micrograph of a biofilm in place. So this is, if you could take a slice through a biofilm about a millimeter high, this is what it looks like in nature. So the top is the stream, and we're going down to the rock here. And it's just full of amazing diversity and complexity, okay? So if you were to pull all this apart and look at what's in here, bacteria, fungi, algae, ciliates, nematodes, and if Mark Young's here, there are viruses as well. And then the products of biology, okay, extracellular polysaccharides that were exuded by these things, exoenzymes, detritus, metals, free ions, and there is an amazing mini ecosystem going on in this biofilm that is complex and super important. If we look at some of the other important herbivores, a few different caddisflies and mayflies, and we zoom in on their mouthparts, each of these taxa have specialized mouthparts that allow them to selectively feed on pieces of this microbial biofilm. Okay, so they're not just out there rah, 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 eating anything. They are going after specific things in this biofilm. And this is an interesting study that came out recently where they allowed these three different taxa to range free on this microbial biofilm here on these tiles. And you can see after a period of days, these different species have completely structured the biofilm in totally different ways. Okay, so the diversity matters. These things are different, and there is complexity at this scale. So when you the next time you pull a rock out of a river, or you slip on a rock when you're fishing, remember that rock in that there's so much going on there. There's a complex ecosystem going on, and if you stepped on this rock, it's likely that you stepped on the equivalent area of about 5 square kilometers in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So stay out of the rivers. Just kidding. So if we come back out, let's zoom back out and think about the species that I just showed you, just a few of these organisms. Those guys only represent a really small fraction of the diversity that exists in rivers right here in Bozeman. Okay, literally hundreds of species interacting, preying on each other, competing. All this stuff is happening, this complexity. It's absolutely mind-boggling to think about how this persists over time. Okay. It gets even more mind-boggling when we think about the broader riverscape, okay, and the fact that these river food webs are connected to other equally complex webs, okay? They're interacting with organisms deep down in the subsurface below the rivers. These food webs are interacting with food webs in the riparian zone, feeding birds, bats, spiders, and so on. And there are upland species, including mammals, that fundamentally depend on and interact with species in the stream, okay? So this is a big deal. These are the sort of observations. These are the incredible observations that ecologists have been making for years and wondering to themselves, no way, how is this possible? How can you have stable, productive ecosystems that are so complex over time? Why don't things just take over or go extinct? How is nature stable? And this is really one of the most important questions in ecology for the past 50, 60 years. And so the question is, are there characteristics of this complexity, are there things about this complexity that give rise to the things we care about, okay? That give rise to species persistence over time, that give rise to productive fisheries, and give rise to things like ecosystem goods and services. In essence, is there order here that leads to these characteristics? Some of the earliest ecologists to sort of start diving into this question were these guys, Charles Elton and Robert MacArthur, really, really important figures in the history of ecology. And they had a hunch that biological diversity is probably important, okay? And there's something about the diversity that leads to the stability of these ecosystems over time, okay? And they thought this because they had done a ton of observations of different ecosystems that were really diverse, like tropical rainforests, thousands and thousands of species interacting. And they observed ecosystems like industrialized agricultural fields, okay, that were way more simplified than the diverse counterparts. And they did this kind of thing. So this is just a cartoon, but each of these little lines kind of represents what you might see in terms of the abundance of a species over time, okay? And so in diverse ecosystems, they noticed that there's ups and downs, but things kind of remain relatively stable. But in these human-dominated systems where the diversity is way lower, the populations are super volatile, okay? Big population outbreaks, big declines, species going extinct, species pest outbreaks taking off. And these are common observations in human-dominated, simplified ecosystems. They're way more volatile, okay, and subject to change. And they're way less resistant to changes that we impose on them. And so they said, okay, so simple communities are more easily upset than richer ones. Okay, this was their idea. And this is, you know, one of the most important sort of early thinking pieces in ecology. And it kind of led to this paradigm. It led to this paradigm that biological diversity, the number of species, leads to ecosystem stability. It leads to the persistence of things like trout production over time. And it leads to the ability of these ecosystems to withstand perturbations. It makes them more resilient to change. Now, this was called into question when Lord Robert May came onto the scene. Okay, this guy was pretty interesting. A PhD in theoretical physics, and then he moved to biology because he knew biology was harder. Okay, and it's true. And he basically came to the table and said, I'm going to bring some mathematical gusto to this, okay? If you guys are saying that species diversity is really, really important, let's do some math and let's do some modeling because I can isolate diversity per se. And so he wrote this monograph, he did tons of work, and basically asked this question, does species diversity alone, per se, promote stability, okay? And he did this by constructing fake food webs on his computer. And this was in this early 1970s, so the computer was probably as big as this room. But he basically varied these food webs from really simple, few species interacting, more species interacting, more diverse. And so he altered diversity, and in doing so, altered the connectance among species, okay, this sort of measure of complexity. And he brought this really interesting math that we still use today, sort of differential calculus, community matrix approaches. These are things that we're still using in ecology today. And he ran these simulations over and over and over, thousands of times. It took him about a few years to do this. And here's his conclusion. Okay? When we isolate and simplify the system to just ask the question, does diversity matter? He found in these simulations that diversity leads to instability. Okay, so the more diverse computer model food webs just were totally volatile, and that was totally in the face of what ecologists understood about nature. Okay, May knew this was a problem. He wasn't stupid. Okay, he knew that there was something missing, and basically at the end of his monograph, he says, "Okay, this is our challenge now. We've got to elucidate the devious strategies that make for stability in natural systems." And so he sort of passed the buck back to the community. And this was the challenge, okay? And he basically set the stage for the next 40 to 50 years of research. And there's been massive amounts of debate about why nature's stable. There's been massive amounts of data collected, theory conducted and developed, experiments conducted to ask this question, what is the relationship between complexity and stability? And does diversity even matter? What have we learned? Okay, so it's been a while. It's been 45 years or so since then. And the punchline is ecologists haven't figured nature out yet completely, okay? But they're getting there. And there's some really, really interesting advances in this area where this is kind of the big take home is that the stable and resilient communities appear to have ordered architectures in that complexity. Okay, so it's not necessarily the species themselves, it's how they're interacting. There are ordered architectures in how they're interacting. And so we can think about, you're building a house, right? You're building a house, you know the sort of load-bearing structures that need to go into this house. You know the angles at which the roof needs to be and things like that. To produce a stable house that's resilient to storms and things like that, right? What we've discovered is that there are equally important configurations or architectures in webs, in natural webs, that lead to stability and resilience to perturbation, okay? The details aren't important here, but there are a few things like an overrepresentation of weak interactions, okay? It turns out those are super, super important. It's also important that there should be very few strong interactions in a row as you move up the food web, okay? So there are a few of these architectural structures that we know are fundamental to producing stability, and that's kind of a huge deal in terms of understanding why complexity is so important. In river ecosystems, a lot of this is borne out. And so when we really start to push ecosystems and disturb them really strongly, for example, going from a huge, naturally functioning ecosystem to massive amounts of drought or loss of many really important species in the ecosystem, extinction, what we see is that we don't just lose the biodiversity, right? We don't just lose the species there. We lose critical parts of that architecture that connects those species, okay? And what happens is that these ecosystems become more volatile and the species change much more over time. So a key take home here is that features of network architecture promote stability and ecological function. And biological complexity is so super important. But we've got a long ways to go. Now, I've been focused on the biology. I want to shift gears and tell sort of another story that's equally as important in terms of the physical complexity, okay? The physical complexity of rivers. And in particular, I want to talk about the super strong environmental force in rivers that is flow, okay? Largely unidirectional flow. Now, at the level of the individual organism, we know that flow has been a defining force in driving the diversification and evolution of things like body shape, behavior, and things like that. And so look at this mayfly. So here's this family of mayflies, Heptagenetidae, is super streamlined. And it likes to live in really, really fast environments. And it can do so because it can sit in this tiny area right on top of the rock where the flow is essentially still. Okay, so it can live in really, really fast environments and still take advantage of the food resources in those environments. Here's another guy, this Dipterid, Blepharoceridae. They're not so streamlined, and they love to live in these fast environments, but they've evolved these ventral suckers on their bodies, and so they actually can grab on and suck to the rock and exist in these environments. Other species do a good job of using flow to procure food. So black flies, amazing black flies, stick their butts on the rocks with silk, and then they lift their heads up into the water column and wave this fan on their heads and capture bacteria-sized particles. And so they just sit there, and you can watch this if you want. If you have a snorkel, you can actually see this happening. And they just grab the bacteria, eat it, grab the bacteria, eat it. It's amazing. Net-spinning caddisflies, incredible, okay? These guys spin silk nets and capture food from the water column, okay? So the point is that at the level of the individual, flow has driven massive amounts of evolution and diversification. But flow expresses complexity at lots of other scales, okay? Flow produces riffles, pools, runs, and things like that in rivers, but it also expresses this complexity at a slightly longer spatial and temporal scale. And one of the most important ones in rivers is, of course, flow produces what we call flow regimes. And basically, a flow regime is just a characteristic pattern of hydrology or flow over the course of the year. So how does flow manifest over the course of the year? And here's some examples of very different types of flow regimes in different parts of the world. I like to think of these as flow personalities, okay? Regions around us have flow personalities that are driven by things like climate, topography, soils, and things like that. So around Bozeman, what's our river personality? Snowmelt and spring runoff, okay? So follow me here. There's a lot of data right here, but let's just go through one slice. Here we are on October 1st. It's getting kind of this time of year. The rivers are going down. They get really low. And then in the spring, there's this big pulse of snowmelt, right? And that's 1 year of data. If we move this way on this graph, we're going back in time. So you can see over it's like 25 years or so, there's lots of variation in how big snowmelt is, right? But the point here is that this is a personality, this is a river personality that is predictable, okay? It's predictable. This happens every year, and that, of course, has led to the biological complexity evolving on top of that regime in a certain way. If we go to the desert southwest, things are pretty different, right? So if you've ever gone hiking in Zion National Park in these canyons, you know that certain times of the year, not a good idea. Right? During the monsoon rains, there are super unpredictable massive floods that occur really rapidly. Okay, and so this lovely little stream turns into this torrential flood really super fast. This is a different type of flow personality in the American West. And there are lots of these, and this has really become a pillar of river ecology in terms of the physical template of rivers, okay? We now know that rivers have natural flow regimes, and these vary and express different levels of complexity all around the world, okay? In the American West, there are lots of different ones of these. And they're defined by personality traits. So they're defined by things like the magnitude of flows, how frequently we see floods, how long floods last, the predictability of those things and rates of change and so on, okay? We've learned a lot, and we can now describe these lovely personalities of rivers around the world. We also are starting to get a much better handle on why the natural flow regime is important. Okay, so we now know that there are critical flows that do things like are important for forming the channel of the river, for building complexity of habitats in terms of riffles, runs, pools, depositional zones, erosional zones, and so on. And there are critical flows for connecting the river to its floodplain under natural conditions. In addition, we know that flows are really important because they drive the life history evolution of the biology. And so there are certain times of the year when flows change really rapidly that cues organisms to do things like disperse, okay? Or it cues organisms to go into their pupation phase so they can avoid this big snowmelt pulse, okay? Other times of the year, of course, are cues, life history cues, for things to spawn or things to recruit. Okay, so we know there's a super strong connection between the natural flow regime and the evolution of biological complexity on top of that. Both of these things together are extremely, extremely important. Now, one of the more interesting timing events around here is the emergence of salmon flies, right? Does anybody fish with salmon flies? A couple people? Okay, Pteranarcis californica is this huge, huge stonefly. And every year, it comes out, right? But it's so closely tied to certain conditions in the river that when it emerges varies over time, okay? And it varies because of differences in flow that affect temperature. So Lindsay Albertson, who's sitting right here, our very own in the Department of Ecology, has been working on how flexible is that, okay? Or how much variation is there in when salmon flies emerge from the river, and what are the drivers of that change? And what she's found is really convincing evidence, at least here in the Madison River, that in years of low snowpack, the rivers go down pretty rapidly. They warm up in the spring, so you have really warm spring temperatures, and the salmon flies come off in about mid-June, okay? In years where we have lots of snowpack, really high snowmelt, much colder temperatures, these guys come off about a month later, okay? So even though they're sort of hardwired to come off during snowmelt, they're so closely tied in terms of these cues that little changes in how river flow happens leads to big changes in when these things come out and emerge, and big changes in when you can go fishing for them. But of course, we're not the only ones who take advantage of these things. These are really important energy sources for lots of birds around this area as well. These are beautiful pictures, Mike McDonald, who's sitting right here. Now, in the desert southwest, we've got a different situation. It's not so predictable, right? So you have these rivers that are little tiny trickles in the morning, and then you get a big monsoon rain, and it can literally look like this. This is the same stream here, okay? So big, huge flash floods just blow these rivers out. In response, the biology has evolved life histories to deal with this, right? So the organisms that we see in these rivers are fantastically fast at getting their lives over with. They can get in really fast. They grow. This complexity happens over the course of just weeks, right? All these things are interacting, feeding on each other, and they emerge. Within weeks, they're gone. They mate, and they're dead. Okay? But the point is that the biology, the community, is so strongly tied to the flow regime in terms of how they've evolved over time. Okay? And this varies all over space. These different flow regimes lead to different types of complexity, and that's so, so important in rivers. So, another take home, okay? I talked about biological complexity, and now I talked about physical complexity. Physical complexity is the template, the fundamental template that sets the stage for biological complexity to evolve. And it's these things together that provide the goods and services that we depend on in rivers, okay? And so if we tinker with these things, there's going to be consequences for the provision of these goods and services. Okay, so you knew this part of the talk was coming. I'm going to talk about how we, our activities are starting to dismantle and remove complexity from rivers, okay? But I won't make it too sad, I don't think. So how are we doing this? We're doing this in lots of different ways. Big changes to land use, development. We're over-applying fertilizers and making our rivers more green. There's invasive species like tamarisk in the western U.S. that's taken over riparian zones. And of course, there's climate change that's fundamentally restructuring temperatures and communities and all that stuff. But I don't want to talk about any of that. Okay, I want to talk about a perturbation that I think is probably more important. I already gave it away. And it's this. It's dams. Okay, so dams are fundamentally restructuring the way these ecosystems work. This is a picture of Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River above the Grand Canyon. And it's an amazing feat of engineering, right? It's providing storage of water. It's providing water for irrigation. It's providing hydropower that's really cheap and quick, and we use these things, and it's important. This is just one of many. So if we look at the Colorado River watershed here, almost every major tributary goes into a reservoir, and there's a dam, and then almost every major tributary has a big water diversion. So in a big way, we've completely changed the natural flow regime of the Colorado River. This isn't unique, okay? This isn't unique at all. The Columbia River is the same way. It is completely restructured by dams. The Sacramento River, the Missouri River here in Montana, okay, this is a big deal. We've totally restructured flows. In Montana, there's about 3,500 dams that are on the dam registry, okay? There are more. We know there are more because of tiny farm ponds that aren't registered or stock ponds and things like that. So we're not immune to this in Montana. Our flows have changed drastically over the past century and a half. This was a super important paper by Christer Nilsson and some other colleagues that did this huge analysis that said, well, how many rivers globally have been influenced by dams in terms of being regulated or fragmented? And they find that most, okay, so the majority, 60% of rivers globally are either strongly or moderately impacted in some way by dams. So that's a huge, huge transformation of the hydroscape. And it's not gonna stop. And interestingly, there's been kind of a recent renaissance in interest in hydropower, not necessarily in the U.S., but places like Canada and China. But the real hotspots are South and Central America, Southeast Asia, and Eastern Europe. These are places where there are tons of dams under construction, more dams planned. And so we've got a chance, right? We have an opportunity to inform this as this kind of thing moves forward. Now, it's a big deal. So the changes to the flow regime aren't small when we put in these large dams. So this is the Flaming Gorge. This is below Flaming Gorge Dam on the Green River here in the west. And you can see prior to construction of the dam, the river is expressing this natural complexity. It's low flows in the fall and winter, and then big pulse flows in the spring and summer. Here we go. We build the dam, and we've stretched out the flows throughout the year. So more or less, we've homogenized when flows are coming out of the base of that dam for good reason, right? To distribute water to irrigators, to produce hydropower and things like that. But the bottom line is that we have completely changed the hydrology. Now, our colleague Leroy Poff at Colorado State University has done a huge amount of research trying to understand whether rivers are losing their uniqueness. Okay, he's done a bunch of this globally. This particular analysis is for the continental U.S. And let me see if I can explain this. So this is a metric of hydrologic uniqueness. How unique are different regions in the U.S. in terms of their flow before the construction of dams versus after the construction of dams, okay? And the way to interpret this graph is that because these regions are all below this dotted line, That means that since construction of the dams, rivers are literally losing their personalities. And we've homogenized flows, not just within an individual system, but across regions. So flow regimes across all these different regions in the Southwest, in the Northern Rockies, are looking very, very similar, okay? I think this is us here, MRM, something Rocky Mountain. I don't remember what the M is. In response, of course, the biology is becoming homogenized as well. We've lost a bunch of biodiversity, but we've also gained a number of invasive species that make these rivers more similar in terms of their biological communities, okay? Some are calling this, we're moving into a homogenescene. Maybe that's just another buzzword, but it's true that rivers biologically look more similar over space. Now, this is back to the Flaming Gorge Dam in Utah, and this is prior to the dam had it's kind of a hyper-diverse amount of mayflies in this river. So this is just one group of invertebrates in the river, 16 different species. Since construction of that dam, we're down to 2. So an 88% decline in biodiversity of just this one group, okay? In the Colorado River below Glen Canyon Dam, mayflies are gone. Okay, they don't exist there anymore, and things like New Zealand mud snails have completely taken over. Now, research in my laboratory here and that of my students here at MSU have been working on trying to understand when we lose this biodiversity, what does that do to the architecture, to the structures of these networks, okay? Because now we know that there are characteristic structures that impart stability to ecosystems over time. And so this is just descriptions of energy flow and interactions between species in these communities, way down away from Glen Canyon Dam, moving closer right here, even closer, and here we are right below Glen Canyon Dam, okay? The food webs have become highly simplified, and we start to see a lot of these destabilizing architectures. Okay, we've lost a bunch of the weak interactions, and we have a lot of multi-layered, super strong interactions. And it's true that if you follow the Glen Canyon food web over time, it is volatile. Okay, fishing's great some years, and it's really not so great other years. And so it's there are big changes as we move closer to these dams in terms of the network structure. My student Eric Scholl, who's sitting right here, is working on similar questions in the Missouri River. So he's building these networks below Fort Peck Dam to understand what construction of the dam has done to complexity and what are the implications for things like the endangered pallid sturgeon, which we're trying to recover in that ecosystem. So those are some of the kinds of things that we're trying to do in my lab. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, you're just bashing dams, what are we going to do? You're just not being very positive. Dams are really important, and they are, okay? I'm not here to vilify them at all. We all benefit from dams, right? We store and distribute water very effectively. They do provide a very clean source of power. They provide recreation and all these things. But those are balanced with these ecological costs, right? And so it's not about, should we have dams or should we not have dams? We have dams and we will have dams, okay? Otherwise, we have to tell people to leave or not have children and things like that, and that's not going to happen. The real challenge is trying to balance these two things, right? Balance the costs and benefits and figure out a way to coexist with the amazing ecological complexity that exists in rivers. So what do? We could take a page out of Edward Abbey's novel, and we can just blow up dams. Is anybody up for that? We're probably not going to do that, okay? But in certain places, like the Elwha River in 2014, they did blow up dams. But they did that because the costs of those dams, in terms of the loss of food security for Native communities in this area, far outweighed the benefits, the little benefit provided by power generation, okay? So here's an example where it made sense to blow up the dam. Okay. How much does this guy get paid an hour to sit in that thing? That's got to be tough. Now, the other thing that we've tried to do is impart little bits of the natural flow regime back into the ecosystem. Okay. So on the Colorado River below Glen Canyon Dam, there have been a series of experimental floods where we let water go and hope that we're getting kind of back to the natural flow regime. Okay. And let me just put these floods in context. Here's this green line is the historic flow regime in the Colorado River. Big, huge snow pulse, snow melt, months long of you know, in terms of water flowing out of the dam. Here's the flow regime today. Okay, these little squiggles are for making power every day. And here's one of these experimental floods. Okay, so while these things are actually really effective at redistributing sediments for camping and things like that, they haven't been as effective at reinstating some of the biological complexity that we're trying to achieve to support things like endangered humpback chub and fishes. Now, where are we going? So this is kind of the heading into the cutting edge. This is where we sort of have to go. And the Australians and the South Africans were way ahead of the game. And they've been talking about this for years because they sort of came to a point of crisis way before we did in terms of water scarcity. And they came up with this idea of designer flow regimes where we could modify the flow regime to accommodate human use while still maintaining some of the ecological functions that we think are critical in the ecosystem, right? So here's the natural flow regime in light gray, and here is the modified flow regime to accommodate human use. In this case, they're able to take half of the water, a whole half of the supply of water for the things that humans need, right? But then put back in some of these ecological cues that are so critical for maintaining biological complexity. So retaining floods, maintaining low flows, providing these spring flushing flows that are certain cues to certain fishes in these rivers, and so on. Okay, so designer flows is an idea that is coming. There's a big sort of political and policy hurdle to get beyond this, but it's certainly where we're headed. This is a paper that just came out in Science a few years ago related to the Mekong River. Because there are lots of dams proposed for this in Southeast Asia, and there are dams being constructed right now. And what these authors basically showed through modeling is that if they put some more shoulders on this flood pulse, theoretically they could actually benefit food security in the region. Okay, this remains to be tested, but this is the types of models that are being developed to say, these dams are going in, can we use them to benefit the things that we're interested in? And this is my final example, okay? And this is another paper that was published recently in Nature that is dealing with the San Juan River in the Southwest. And I really thought this paper was interesting because their goal here is to figure out an optimal designer flow regime that can do three things, okay? That can provide all of the irrigation water that's necessary in this environment, provide a flow regime that benefits the native fish, and provide a flow regime that actually minimizes the success of non-native fish, okay? This model that they built is based on knowledge. It's based on what we understand about the biology of these species, okay? So they ran this model, and here we are with the designer flow. The numbers aren't important. The important thing here is that with their designer flows, where they use this sort of fancy optimization technique, they were able to provide all the irrigation water necessary. They were able to benefit the native fishes quite nicely and do a really good job of sort of preventing non-native fishes from taking over. That's pretty cool. What's even more interesting to me, though, is that when you compare that response to mimicking the natural flow regime, going all the way back in time to what the natural flow regime of the San Juan River looks like, that flow regime didn't perform as well, okay? And that's because there are new players in the community. There are invasive species that have taken over. So the baseline has shifted, right? We can't just go back to the way flows were 150 years ago. Our ecosystems have changed. And so now we've got new knowledge about the biology of these ecosystems. It's time to apply our knowledge about biological complexity in a really effective way in terms of managing our dams. So I think we have a really, really big opportunity. Okay, so let's do some take-homes, okay? And I hope that I've convinced you of a couple things. Have I convinced you of this? Oh, good. Healthy rivers are physically and biologically complex, okay? And that complexity is something that has evolved over millions and millions of years. This complexity represents more than just diversity. Okay, I'm not saying diversity isn't important. We need this biological diversity. But complexity is related to various ways that the diversity interact with one another, the architecture of their interactions. Removing this complexity is going to compromise these ecosystem goods and services that we so strongly depend on. Okay, and so we need to be thinking hard about doing these types of things. And finally, I think there's hope, okay? Our understanding of complexity is what's going to allow us to sustainably manage our rivers into the future. We need to embrace complexity, right? We need to embrace the idea that ecosystems are complex, and we need to move into monitoring networks of species and their interactions rather than just monitoring, say, this fish population or that invertebrate population. We need to put these ecosystems together and think about how they work. And when we do that, I think we've got a chance in terms of managing our rivers into the future.